Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Jay Hughes, a.k.a. Dr. J, and I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. I'm speaking with Dr. James Austin. He's a professor emeritus of neurology at the University of Colorado and a philosophy affiliate professor at the University of Idaho. Welcome, Dr. Austin.
How are you, Dr. Hughes?
We're talking today about your mammoth and hard to ever duplicate, I'm sure, Zen and the Brain work, which you published a couple years ago, last year, 1998.
Come out in soft cover in 99.
Uh-huh.
And again in this year.
There are links to it from our website at changesurfer.com. And people who aren't familiar with the Buddhist canon won't know the term Abhidharma, but the Buddhist canon can be broken down into three basic sections. There's the stories in the middle, there's the moral codes at the beginning for the monks, and at the last third of the Buddhist canon is the psychological teachings. I really see your book as both in weight and in completeness, comprehensiveness, being a modern Abhidharma in terms of describing all of the different neurological research and neurological texts, as it were, at the time that would be relevant to connecting Buddhist teachings and Buddhist experience to contemporary neurology. Was that your goal, to have that kind of comprehensive neurological approach?
It was my goal, but I didn't think that of it as duplicating anything that had gone on centuries before.
You weren't trying to one-up the Abhidharma scholars.
Definitely not.
Yeah. Now, neurological research into altered states of consciousness was pretty big in the 70s, and I did a little work on that as an undergraduate. But it's been my impression that it had really gone out of vogue in the 80s as the backlash against anything countercultural swept through the country. Is it true that there was a dearth of research in the 80s, and is that research becoming more popular now?
I think that's accurate. I think the other reason that research tended to fade out in this area was that we had only EEGs and certain physiological measurements of respiration, pulse, and blood pressure. And now we're into ways of neuroimaging the active human brain that I hope in this new millennium will bring some new perspectives to the old problems.
Mm-hmm. We're doing a lot with PET scanning now and isolating particular parts of the brain that heat up when different activities are performed, and you suspect that some of that may be applied to this research now.
I think it will. Mm-hmm. I did PETs. I was the subject of a PET study maybe a decade or so ago, and the problem there is that everything that you get is sort of averaged over many minutes time. So you need multidisciplinary techniques that combine electrical methods of studying the brain with other neuroimaging techniques that study the metabolism and the blood flow of the brain.
One of the really unique and interesting things about your text is that, as you've described it, it's an opening text in experiential neurology, the attempt to approach neurology from the phenomenological perspective and link that to the materialistic scientific perspective. And so you have a lot of descriptions of your own meditative experiences and over the last 25 years as you've been slowly writing this book. And that's pretty unusual, as you note, that very few neurologists ever talk about their own experience. There are very few Oliver Sacks's. Oliver Sacks writes about his patients, but it doesn't write very much about himself.
Yes. I feel there's a definite place to try to write your own narratives of what it is you actually experience. It's very important, I think, to try to put them and put your experiences in words. It's a challenge, but it's very, very important, I think.
Mm-hmm. especially in this field where the experience in words is by definition considered to be a pale reflection of what it actually is. But
that's what it is, a very pale reflection.
Yeah. Now, in the meditative experience, you have described a series of stages that one goes through, beginning with an ordinary mind, and you describe what ordinary attentiveness is all about. Excuse me. And then you talk about the initial meditator's mind and some of the things that tend to happen as you quiet the mind and focus, cut off external stimuli, sit in a quiet place, and so forth. There's a great deal of research that's been done on sensory motor deprivation, the whole tanking thing that started in the 60s and continues today. And one of the phenomena you talk about that's common in Japanese Zen is makyo. What are makyo?
Makyo are hallucinations, really, that are usually in the visual sphere, but they may include sensations of touch or physical presence or occasionally noises of various kinds. And one, I think, can best think of them as hallucinations that supervene when the brain is deprived of incoming sensation and is also deprived of the opportunity to express all its energy and motion. So I think sensory deprivation is better looked at as a kind of sensory motor deprivation. You need to burn off your energy some way with physical action if you sit for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
In Zen, this is accomplished by walking meditation, getting up, moving around, by working, by sweating.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of what people think about when they think about altered states of consciousness or meditation is that people are trying to create these kinds of experiences, that the goal is to sit down and have visions of some kind. And in fact, other meditative traditions do have those, but in Buddhism the focus is different.
It certainly is. And without making any invidious comparisons, there's a big tradition that for centuries has welcomed the vision quest as a quest to experience visions of one kind or another. Zen doesn't really pay much attention to this. Zen is more interested in the insights that develop, the intuitions that develop that don't require a lot of sensory play. Zen is interested in what you can comprehend, not what you can get through your visual senses.
Mm-hmm. Now, the same thing would apply to a lot of the research and a lot of the culture that attempted to connect psychedelic drugs and various other drugs, marijuana, whatever, to meditative experiences. Now, you don't hold that meditation is a better way to get high and accomplishes the same things as LSD. You discuss LSD and it's the research that's been done on it, but
yes,
it's two different things.
I think the research that's been done in psychedelics has been very stimulating to the whole movement to try to understand what consciousness really is. But I'm in favor of meditation, not medication, as a way to arrive, or at least to travel a spiritual path.
Mm-hmm. And finally, there's the whole sphere of religious experiences which are ecstatic. And in some Buddhist traditions, there is chanting and various kinds of the same kind of absorptive, repetitive physical and verbal activity that would lead to possession trance in other traditions. And in Tibetan Buddhism, there is possession trance. But possession trance is very different than the kinds of meditative experience that Zen is talking about, and physiologically different, isn't it?
I like to think of it as being, but chanting also occurs in ordinary Zen traditions, as do other forms of ritual. They're not prominent, however, and it's not an opportunity to get so intensively possessed by an idea or a feeling or a flickering candle flame that sensory overload takes over the whole mental sphere. Mm-hmm. The Zen approach is more in the direction of quiet meditation and coming back time and time again to just the experience of breathing in and out. Breathing in and out, your breath is something that you carry with you at all times. You don't need an instrument. You don't need to plug in the instrument in the wall to experience Zen meditation. You just follow your breath.
For those of you who are just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. James Austin. He's the author of Zen and the Brain, a 1998 text, which is a comprehensive exploration of that topic. As you say, the first meditation object that most Zen practitioners are given is the breath meditation, and they are asked to concentrate on that breath. And you have did the interesting research on the effect of both meditation on breathing, aside from yogic breathing control, which is another whole topic, but just being in a meditation state actually has an effect on your breathing.
Yes, it does, in two ways. First, as you become calm, you breathe more slowly, and you tend to move more into abdominal breathing and out of plain thoracic breathing. And then, if you go into deeper moments that correspond to the absorptions, there may be a period during which you're really not breathing in or out for a number of seconds. There's kind of a respiratory arrest at a time in which consciousness seems to be very clear and clarified.
You also talked about the fact that the between the outgoing breaths and the incoming breaths shifts in favor of outgoing breaths.
Right. And expiration is lengthened.
And you found that to be significant because of its effect neurologically.
Neurophysiologically, particularly in animal research, the period of breathing out tends to quiet down the firing of nerve cells in many parts of the brain, including the amygdala, which is one of the sources of a lot of our emotional flavor to things. So it tends to quiet the brain in important ways related to our emotions.
So as we begin to sit down and we begin to quiet the mind, then we have these uprising of these makyo, these various ways that our mind tries to continue to entertain itself in the absence of the traditional sensory phenomenon. And we have the internal thought process, which continues to try to distract us. But we keep concentrating on the breath, and the mind begins to slow down. The next transition that you talk about is the transition to samadhi, or absorptive states. What is an absorptive state?
It's a state in which the intensity of awareness becomes turned up so that one becomes powerfully aware of what is going on within the field of attention at that moment. The field of attention may be externally directed. It might be externally directed toward a candle, let's say, or even a chair. Or it may be internally directed, in which case the person may have a sense of remarkable space opening out seemingly into infinity, filled with nothing but darkness, extreme blackness. And later in the experience, permeated by a kind of bliss. But I think if absorption is heightened, very extraordinarily heightened attention, either toward internal events or toward external items and events.
Now, some of the early research on altered states of consciousness attempted to put our attentive processes in an evolutionary context and talked about the way that it's simply maladaptive for us to pay attention to everything at once, that we wouldn't be functioning as animals. And so we have these hunter-gatherer instincts to focus our attention, to habituate to things which are not dangerous, and to concentrate on things that we want to eat or fight. the process of Zen meditation, as you describe it, has to do partly with dehabituating and becoming concentrated attention to break down that process of habituation. Is that is that correct?
Well, one of the ideas is to maintain the freshness of experience rather than to get into states of jaded experience that are part of the general mindlessness with which we usually approach ordinary life. What you find as a result of Zen meditation and Zen training is that it becomes a kind of a art appreciation course. After an art appreciation course, and while you're taking it, you can go into a museum and look into a picture and see new things about it, things that the artist put in it that you never saw before. And that's true of the way prolonged meditative training tends to create a freshness and a novelty, a way to read between the lines of the natural things in the world.
Now, one of the things that happens, as you describe it, and is central to Buddhist teaching, is the notion that as you become freshly aware of the internal workings of your mind, you begin to see the way that your mind attaches I, me, my to various thoughts, feelings, emotions, and you begin to lose the habitual clinging and boundary creation around the self. And that's referred to in Buddhist teachings as the doctrine of no self, that there is no intrinsic observer or thing that you can find inside your head that is a self. And you think that neurology and, you know, that this is very consistent with neurology.
I think it is, but for ways that I only start to go into in the book. Pathways are pre-existing in the brain that actually can be looked at in experimental animals and divide the way we perceive things into two general compartments. One of them is an egocentric kind of compartment, and that refers everything back to the physical presence, to the head, the eye, and the neck, and the trunk of the person who's doing the seeing. The other set of pathways tend to look at the world outside as a kind of a space out there with no reference at all to the person who's inside doing the seeing. And that's called the allocentric kind of perception. It contrasts with the egocentric kind of perception that we ordinarily think of ourselves as undergoing when we look at something and say, hey, that's my comb, or that's my book, or that's my car.
This is also connected to the fact that as a part of our body, we have a whole sense of proprioception of all the different sensations of our body that we put together as a package. And it's probably the infant's first sense of self is when they start to associate all of these different sensations of their body as connected to them, to this fiction of them. And that's another thing that breaks down sometimes in Zen meditation, correct?
It starts breaking down during meditation, and that the sense of a physical self drops off during the absorptions. But the sense of the real sense, the unconscious sense that bolsters the I, me, mind, that doesn't really drop off until one gets into the experience of Kensho or Satori, which is kind of major peak experience. These are the phrases that Zen attaches to the experience. But they are major peak experiences, and that is really the time in which you really make the first big progress, if progress can be called progress, in being aware that the self is really something that is transitory. you can lose it, and that's okay.
So Kensho's and Satori's are sudden breakthrough experiences, peak experiences that you have usually during meditation, which usually not during meditation.
Yeah, absorptions are usually associated with meditation,
uh-huh.
periods of meditation. But Kensho and Satori, I would say most of them, or the majority of them, may tend to occur maybe after you've been meditating for a while. Or if you're in a meditative retreat, they don't necessarily occur while you're sitting in meditation or when you're walking in meditation, but they may occur when you're out looking at the sunset.
By the way, I'm speaking with Dr. James Austin. He's a neurologist and philosopher on the faculty of emeritus at the Faculty of University of Idaho and on the faculty emeritus at the Faculty of University of Colorado and currently on the faculty at the University of Idaho. And he's written the book Zen and the Brain. Now, so Kensho experience is kind of like, in computer terms, the reset button on your computer, a reboot suddenly that allows you to flush away all the corrupted programs and everything that have caused you to get your blue screen of death.
Well, if you wish. I'd say the important thing is that in Kensho, you sort of decondition yourself of all of your previous conscious and unconscious conditionings, particularly those related to your longings, your innermost longings and your innermost loathings, to any deep angers or fears or extreme desires. So you detach from all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And what is left is not something inferior in any way, but something rather that seems simplified and very affirmative in tone.
One of the paradoxes of Buddhist philosophy is the doctrine that the insight, the penetrating insight that can develop through these meditative states and through the sudden breakthroughs that one has, will reveal the emptiness of all the mental constructs that you have, so that you see that there's no such thing as self, you see that all the things around you are relatively meaningless or whatever, however you want to frame it. That's more nihilistic than it should be framed. But at the same time, there's this assertion that you will get in touch with an intrinsic empathy and compassion for all beings, all living things, and their suffering.
Well, I'd say that you, during the moment of Kensho or Satori, the feeling is more that you are in touch with things as they really are. Things as they really are, as opposed to ways you've been feeling about them in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And after several episodes of this, of getting rid of the self and all the fictions and conditioning of the self, then there occurs a gradual opening up to things in the outside world and a feeling that they are intrinsically worthwhile. And at that point, compassion starts seeping into the equation.
So is there any research that's been done that documents the greater empathy on the part of meditators?
Yes, there was some very superficial research that was done that measured a number of psychological indices of empathy that suggested that even after short periods of meditation, the degree of empathy could be increased in naive subjects. Longitudinal studies, I think, need to be done that span a period of years to really grapple with this question of what compassion, genuine compassion, really is, and how and why it evolves.
Well,
I hope will be done in the future.
One of the nice things about your book, and of course as a lifelong scientist, you would expect this to come out, but you generate 22 hypotheses or 20 hypotheses about testable effects of meditation or neurological consequences of meditation. That's wonderful. Is anyone taking you up on trying to test out any of these theories or advance
this? I hope they are, but nobody has written me and said, hey, we're trying to test you out on this one. Do you have any thoughts or anything else? So I'm not aware, but I do hope indeed that this will be done and that these questions will be answered in this new millennium, particularly in the next decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a burgeoning field of pain management consultants, people doing heart disease studies, who are using superficial meditation, relaxation technique training, Kabat-Zinn's work comes to mind at Harvard, to have a variety of health effects for people.
Yes.
And
Benson's group at Harvard, along with Kabat-Zinn mm-hmm. and others, all over, really, the world, have been making advances and putting meditative methods out for the general public in ways that seem very salutary.
And a lot of the benefits that you talk about are benefits that come from even the most superficial meditation experiences. For instance, you talk about that in basic meditation experience, one will go through a certain amount of sleep processing, not necessarily falling asleep, but doing some of the same mental states that would be alpha, theta, or gamma wave states of sleep. Is that true?
Well, meditators do fall asleep, and they also sort of move down in the general direction of deeper sleep. And they also, having done so, then come up out of those phases nearing sleep into moments of awareness in which they may overshoot a little bit. So I think if anybody is going to study meditation carefully, they need to really pay attention to how often ordinary meditators go in and out of various phases of sleep and how important those transition periods are to moments of feeling more awake and more clear and more with it.
Such a critical problem today, because sleep deprivation, both the kinds of moral and the kinds of lifestyle one would need to maintain, which traditionally has been considered a moral lifestyle, but just not partying all the time, not being involved in various kinds of life-threatening pursuits in order to have a meditative lifestyle, and also the meditation itself would address a lot of the problems that we have in terms of sleep deprivation and its various health effects.
Satchel Paige put it very well when he said, avoid the social ramble. It ain't restful.
Exactly. Now, my final question to you, and you, we've talked about this briefly before, and so I know that you don't write about this in your book, and it's probably not the direction you're going. But neurology has developed a number of wonderful instrumentations. Both the neurofeedback technologies that are being applied have been applied for 30 years to pain management, the induction of various kinds of restful relaxation states, attention deficit disorders being treated with neurofeedback. And the combination of that with the direction that we're probably going to go in the near decades of direct silicon neural interface. You've laid out a roadmap here of how meditation affects the brain and the various mechanisms involved. Don't you see some future combination of chemistry and technology that would facilitate a more rapid, more technologically oriented approach to all of these kinds of training?
I see something like this, Dr. Hughes. There are a lot of ordinary people in life, like you and I started out, who find it difficult to meditate because they soon become aware that they have a monkey mind that's jumping all around all the time with a blizzard of thoughts going on. And for those people, and everybody I think starts out this way, it can be helpful to go into a laboratory and maybe have some of these elementary techniques that help them get some kind of alpha or other feedback so that they will identify what it is that they're looking for or what, when they feel calm and so forth. So as a way to introduce oneself to the elementary principles of meditation, yes, I think that some of the techniques that you've cited may have some value. But beyond that, the meditative training we're talking about needs to really sort of practice with things that don't need to be plugged in, that need to be out in nature, looking at trees and grasses and sunsets. We don't need to get into consumerized, ever more virtual forms of reality. We need ways of getting into ordinary things that you can do. We need to get into ways that you can look at this monkey mind and bring it back by an effort of your own internal will time and time again to your breathing. And these are all sort of common sense ways of approaching meditative training. They don't need extra instrumentation. They need more self-recognition. They need more self-discipline. And these are the things I think that you learn in the traditional meditative approach that you, of course, have already undergone.
Mm-hmm. Well, I this is the end of the interview, and I want to recommend to people that they read Zen in the Brain. I want to thank you, Dr. Austin. Can people email you? Oh, no, they can't email you, but if they go to my website, they can find out how to get the book and email me, and I can give them information to contact you. Would that be okay?
Sure. It's okay. An MIT Press book, and it's in soft cover, and it's, I think, available now.
Yes, I have it. Thank you very much, Dr. Austin.
My pleasure, Dr. Hughes. Thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS-FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.